Blog Talk Radio.
It's Monday night, 10 p.m., the latest episode of Graphic Policy Radio. This is the show for folks who care about whether people are being killed with drone strikes as well as whether Superman kills. Tonight we have a guest, comic creator Tom Christopher, to talk first day. A comic helped create with the Union IBW Local 1245. So as an artist, Tom has been involved in fanzines, underground comics, and the New Wave comics movement, but he's probably best known for a seven-year run as anchor on Marvel's Silver Surfer. Since then, he has worked with a variety of titles from Marvel and DC, including Spider-Man, X-Men, Superman, and Batman, and he's also a writer penning definitive biography of Beat Generation writer Neil Cassidy in documented early comic book history. So he'll be up in a moment, but before we get to that, joining me is always the fantastic Alana. How you doing?
Hello, I'm great. Really excited for the show today.
Yeah, it should be cool. I heard you make a slight noise about my intro about the drone strikes in Superman.
Yeah. We should definitely talk about the movie later. I still have not seen
yes.
it, but it sounds like you might have an opinion of some kind.
Yes, we'll see. So right now I'm calling in Tom, and hopefully this works. This will be the second person we've ever called. Usually they call us.
Hello?
Tom?
Hello, Tom.
Yes.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
You're on the air with Graphic Policy Radio. I'm Brett, and then Ella with me is Alana. How you doing?
Very well, and yourself?
We're great. So just a quick story on how we found out about this comic. I email a lot with folks who do online communications for labor unions, including the IBEW, which for those who don't know is the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. And I got a press release from them saying that one of the local groups of the union, was just releasing a comic book to use as part of their new member orientation materials. And the second I heard that, we knew we had to get this guest on our show, because if there's two things I'm obsessed with, it's labor unions and comic books, and the opportunity to discuss those at the same time is pretty awesome. I know on this show we've been really big fans of using the comics medium as a way to talk about complicated subject matter and to engage people in some kinds of media, and we're just really excited to have you on the show.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank you for your interest in the subject.
So, you have to tell me. I'm sorry, go ahead, Brett.
Well, I was going to say, before we even get to the talk about the IBW comic, like I always feel like the first question needs to be is, how did you begin and start in the comic industry? Because you've been a long-time veteran, so it's always interesting to hear how people started off.
Well, I probably... like most people, I started out a reader, and I used the available forms of communication with other fans at the time, fanzines. And I worked in fanzines and ended up doing some undergrounds. And then as time went on, the undergrounds became alternatives. And by that time, I had gone to New York a couple of times and was starting to fit in there. And, kind of kept working. It all was pretty much an outgrowth of my interests.
Great. How did this particular project come about? Did the union approach you, and how did you come to their attention as the right artist for this job?
Well, actually, I know the business manager of the union, Tom Dalzell, socially, and I didn't know of his affiliation with the union. We have some shared interests. He's a fan of the Beat Riders, and so am I. And he's a very literate guy. He's done some dictionaries of slang. And we met through friends, and I approached him when I found out that he was connected with the CIO. I approached him to help me navigate through the bureaucracy there and talk to some people about possibly producing some comics. and he thought that was a great idea, and he presented me with this opportunity. And his guy, I don't want to say a assistant, but Eric Wolf, who works closely with Tom, had produced a really nice history of the union, the local 1245, and they were looking for another way of presenting that as a teaching tool for new members, and they thought comics would be a great idea, and I concurred. I thought it would be too.
That's fantastic. So
yes,
have
you
originally
you.
Wanted, but the concept of doing a union-oriented comic book was something that you had come to the National Association of Unions, which is called the AFL-CIO, you had come to them wanting to do that work initially, right?
Yes, yes.
So what did
yes.
inspire
I was,
you
I was
to do
looking
comics about
to,
unions?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that.
Oh, I was just saying, so yeah, so what was it, what inspired you to want to do comics about unions?
Well... I've always been interested in unions. I think they're a good thing. I was I recruited for the Atomic and Oil Workers back when I had a job in a related industry, and I'm currently a member of SEIU, and I just think unions are a real good thing. I've always had an interest in labor unions and labor history.
I used to actually work for SEIU in the communications department. So
oh.
It's certainly, yeah, it's a small world. And
yeah,
you know, one of the
it's
things
a big
folks,
union,
yeah.
too.
That's true. It's the Service Employees International Union, for those who don't know the full alphabet soup. As many acronyms as there are in comics, there are even more, like you've got AIM, and you've got SWORD, and there's just a lot of acronyms in comics. There's even more acronyms in the union world, and I have to constantly remind myself to, like, define stuff for people.
Easily. It's an alternate universe.
But it's really great that you came to them with this, because I know, you know, a lot of folks, we always would try to keep track of what artistic skills our members have that we could use. One of my friends who actually was working on a campaign organizing janitors, had a ton of his members were really good hip-hop artists. So they would, you know, recruit them to do songs for or play at events all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so just, you know, having knowing, like, what artistic skills your members and your staff have access to is something that we always try to keep a handle on. So that's really exciting that you came to them with that idea.
Oh, absolutely. And unions have traditionally known how to use the arts.
That's true. Like, we've commissioned a ton of artwork over time. Some of the amazing narrative murals that you'll see in union offices and in public spaces and all that is really comes from that as well. Your art is really fantastic. You're very classical and formal in your approach. And is your work inspired at all by that sort of works project administration art style, or how did you develop your visual style as an artist?
I really didn't think too much about it. I've kind of been influenced by all the guys I liked, and I some things I don't try and analyze. You know, I couldn't tell you why I like certain people. It's just a gut level feeling of being 10 and going, oh, that's cool. That's cool. I want to do it like that. Yeah.
I really liked the art in the comic. It felt really classic and clean, and just like it filled me with like nostalgia for the days of like good classic solidly drawn comics art, which I feel sometimes is missing in some of the art that we see today. I'm not like a big 90s person.
Well, thank you. I was very lucky. I only did the layouts, and the layouts are solid, but they're really not much more than peanut figures. But all the perspective is there, all the scale is there. The cars are realistic, that sort of thing. But in my version, no one has clothes or faces or like that. Excuse me. So So I have had a very good South American artist, Diego Barreto, who's doing some work for DC right now, as well as my old buddy Joseph Rubenstein, who I've worked with for about 30 years, to help me with the art. And then on top of that, we had Diego's wife, Laura Abella, and a guy named Jim Keplinger doing the letters. Laura was the colorist on this.
Hmm. So it's a real collective effort.
Oh yeah.
My
own efforts are spread so thin in this that I can be very, very proud of it and not feel mm-hmm. immodest.
So what was the process? I mean, with you said when he came in that the director of the communications director of the local union, Eric Wolf, had written this history of the local union, but how did that go from like just a story to a script for a comic book? Because I imagine that's a huge leap to just get to that point.
Yeah. Well, it was a very good history that involved some oral biography in there, too, and a lot of interviews with people who lived during the 30s and 40s as the union was being built up within PG&E. Pacific Gas and Electric out in California. So it was it was pretty well formed by the time I got to it, and I basically designed the soap opera around it, where a guy is coming home from work and he has a history of the union as part of his introductory stuff. And his son is interested in you know, what it is and what it means to be a union member and, you know, the function of unions. And so they have a discussion about it. And, you know, a little fun with dad and some education going on.
Yeah. I definitely learned a lot, and I'm, you know, a pretty big union geek. I'm not surprised to see IBEW embracing the visual medium because they have the coolest logo of all of the unions. And I can say that unabashedly. I haven't looked at a lot of them. For those who don't know, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers logo is a fist of lightning bolts coming out of it, which basically means they're superheroes.
The you charm know. Of lap dogs. yes, it is a very cool logo. And they actually have an older one that is cooler, too. I cannot describe it to you. Unions in general have some very, very nice logos.
Yeah, when I worked for the Musicians Union, they had recently redone their logo, and I really liked the old-fashioned one. And I was like, you guys should do the retro one. People would like it more. It's more retro. And whenever we give out T-shirts, all the younger members always wanted the old T-shirts with the old logo on it rather than the new one.
Yeah, there's something really there's something that draws you in to those old logos, all the American symbolism in them, all the stars and, you know, the number of things. And
yeah, no, it's true. And I think there's something about a lot of comics. I shouldn't say all, but a lot of comics folks are really enjoy like classic Americana imagery, sort of mm-hmm. as part of our visual vernacular. And that's something that a lot of union imagery that you know have been used historically can be very full of as well, you know.
I think so. I think there's a lot of working class imagery. You know, you have guys with their sleeves rolled up and a hammer in their hand and boy, I'm probably going way back here, but I'm thinking of classic Steve Ditko drawings of workers coming out of factories, and everyone has those little painter caps on, and their sleeves are rolled up, and something symbolic, you know, a paintbrush in everybody's hand or a wrench in their pockets, you know, something like that. Jerry Robinson was... I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
Oh, Jerry Robinson was very good at doing that kind of symbolic thing, too.
Hmm. It's interesting because historically comics have been very much identified as a working class medium, and amongst like the readers, you know, that was the assumption that folks had about who was reading them. I'm sure that wasn't a really accurate reflection.
Oh.
I'm sure that everyone was reading comics,
mm-hmm.
but definitely people like see, you know, see themselves reflected in that work, especially back in the earlier part of the, well, mid 20th century, I should say.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, before that, they weren't even considered working class. You know, they at the turn of the previous century, they were considered tools of the illiterate and the criminal classes, and, you know, well up into the 1950s with the comic book burnings and so on.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Yeah, if you do a search, if you go to the New York Times index and do a search under comic strips from like 1900 to 1930, it's all bad news.
Hmm. Like in what? Like it's all critical, or?
Oh, it's very critical. Yeah, and they're designed for the illiterate. People are very up in arms about them.
Yeah.
What I found quite interesting about that time, when you bring up like that early 1900s, is a lot of those early comics, though, were very political. Like they were really smart, taking on class issues that I think that's really overlooked even nowadays. That those earliest of early comics were really political at the heart of them.
They were, and they were political towards immigrant audiences too, and I think
mm-hmm.
I think that was something that bothered the power structure, if you will.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I guess, how about before, like for those who might not know, I probably should actually even take a step back. We just like dove into the union conversation.
Mm-hmm.
In your words, like, what does a union do for people? I mean, I'm sure there's people in our audience who have no idea, you know, the specifics.
Mm. Well, golly, what don't they do? Unions, industrial unionism has really been around for 100 or so years, and if you just look at all the social and technological progress we've made during that time, a big, big chunk of that can be attributed to unions, because it's unions who have allowed a stable workforce to develop and communities to grow, and it's unions who have allowed the economy to be spread throughout the various strata of society.
I think your comic did a fantastic job, actually, defining like what unions do, essentially. You know, talking about how when people come together, they're able to demand that they be treated in a different way and have their fair share of the profits of the work that they do. You know, I think that the comic did just really an excellent, like, this is what unions are 101 explanation for sure.
Yes.
You know, if you're just one person, they can just ignore you. No matter how skillful you are, seriously, if you're just one person, they'll just freaking ignore you. But if everyone comes together and supports each other in solidarity, then you have more power and you can negotiate a fair shake from management.
Absolutely.
Take what you want.
Absolutely. I don't think it can be said better than that. And the stories that these guys are acting out in the book, the whole point of this 20-plus year fight that they were going through to get the union established is solidarity. There were two competing union factions, the AFL and the CIO, and neither one could get a conclusive majority among the workers. And the AFL was really good in the city, and the CIO was real strong in the outlands of San Francisco. All the action in the book takes place in the San Francisco Bay Area. And the company, Pacific Gas and Electric, which was the biggest power company on the coast, possibly in the country, maybe excepting New York, was able to use a variety of political and economic leverages that they had to keep the two factions fighting. And the guy who pulled who finally pulled off the merger between the two factions was a guy named Ron Weakley. And he had been a CIO supporter for a long time and had brought a lot of people, hundreds, probably thousands of people, into the union. And when he saw that no one could get a majority, he went over to the AFL. And that's when IBEW 1245 was set up as a separate union. And they merged the bureaucratic differences between the AFL and the CIO. The CIO had been part of the AFL until about 1933, and then they wanted to exercise an option called industrial unionism, which means unionizing everyone in a plant, from the janitors to the bookkeepers to the advertising people and so on, where the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, kept up the old-style skilled trade union tactics, which had been successful in the previous century, but they'd reached some logical impasses.
I mean, basically what happened was that they felt that only skilled workers, like, for example, linemen, should be able to organize together as a union. So there would be one union for linemen and then a separate union for clerical workers. And in their math, like, the janitorial workers wouldn't even have a union because they were hardly, you know.
That's exactly right. And trade unionism makes a certain amount of sense at the beginning of a unionist movement, because it's those guys, it's the guys who have skilled trades, who are bricklayers and glaziers and so on, that have skills that will be missed immediately if they're withdrawn from society. So that makes a lot of sense, but they could only go so far without unanimity among all of the workers from all the different areas of a factory or of a job site. Even among AFL unions before industrial unionism, if there was a building site and all the electricians got angry about something, they could walk off the job, but the bricklayers would stay on. So there wasn't enough unity to actually fight the working problems that they had, like you were saying. But together, when they finally came together as one union, that's when we got the contract with PG&E. And it took them 20 years to do it.
Also, that's the one thing I like really enjoyed reading through the comic was it showed the struggle, warts and all, like good and bad, was in the comic. I mean, was there's a lot of a lot of people go through and kind of like gloss over that negative history. I mean, was there a thought of like, we need to bring it all out there and really show the struggle that went through? And I mean, was there a conscious effort to really kind of do the warts and all story?
Boy, other than to just tell an honest story and tell, like I was saying, we went back to original interviews with participants from that time. There's actually footage of the big 1934 strike on YouTube in San Francisco. And there were similar strikes in Los Angeles and all the docks down there, and so this is a very, you know, historic time. It's been well documented, and so we just wanted to be as straight with the facts as we could. There's one scene where we fudged a little bit, where we had a couple of guys meeting. We had Ron Weakley meeting with a guy, I cannot think of his name right now, Don Hardy. And Ron Weakley and Don Hardy never could have met. So in this book, we have them meeting casually, and exchanging the stories. And the stories they exchange are true. They couldn't actually have met under the circumstances we, you know, describe here. And that's the one place where we fudged on things, you know, just so we could bring everything together and have a smooth story. But everything else is, you can find it in the books, you can find it in the newspapers, you can find old films of this stuff. It's 100% accurate.
That's really neat. So when was the comic first distributed to membership? Is it just coming out right now?
It's just coming out right now.
Is it going to be available online anywhere?
I assume it will be. There, you know, there's a whole crowd of people that collect political comics and give away comics and that sort of thing. So I assume that there will be people asking the union for it.
Yeah, because I would love to be able to share this with all of our listeners. I really enjoyed it and got a lot out of reading it. And I'd love to keep an eye on this as it goes on to see whether or not other unions decide that this is a good approach for their own member orientation work. And I think it would be, like, really, really cool to see that happening in lots of different places, you know? Yeah.
Well, I am speaking to them this month or next month about doing some more material for them. And I know it's gotten a good response down from the guys that they work with. And the people that I've shown it to personally have liked it.
Well, that's really cool. One of my friends did a comic for a community-based organization in New York that was helping to unionize grocery workers. But the comic was really aimed at the broader community to get the community support the picket that was going on. The grocery store basically was not paying their workers the minimum wage. And so the comic was used to help tell the story of what the workers are experiencing, especially because there was a language barrier. A lot of the people who went to the store were predominantly English-speaking, and a lot of the workers were monolingual Spanish. So the comic was something which they could give to the English speakers and have the English speakers go and, like, actually understand what they were going through. And the community became incredibly supportive of the strike, and they won. The store is union now, and the workers are getting more than minimum wage. And so that was the only other was the only rather recent comic, a union comic story I can think of off the top of my head. It's for Golden Farm and Grocery in Brooklyn. The community group is New York Communities for Change. Yeah.
Ah, okay. What part of Brooklyn was that?
It was Windsor Terrace, actually, Windsor Terrace.
I'm not familiar with right there.
That's okay.
That's
it's not,
interesting.
It's a very residential area. Like, you wouldn't go there unless you're, like, visiting somebody, you know?
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I've had friends in Brooklyn. I've lived in Manhattan. It's a very nice place, the park and, you know, Flatbush and... is it Third Avenue out to the bridge that has all those varying ethnic neighborhoods by block?
It's the most special
place
in the world.
That is a great use of a comic. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad it worked for them. New York has actually had some union activity over the past few months with the fast food workers going out.
Mm-hmm.
All that is very nice to see. It's with all the economic stuff that's come down over the last few years, you know, people are taking note again, I think, of unions, and the response I'm getting from non-union members is that you know, people need to see this kind of material to be reminded of what it was like just 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And also, like,
you know,
how hard it was to win and what it took to win, you know? I think a lot of people, like, give up, you know, and they feel like nothing, like things are hopeless and that they can never win. And I think seeing how hard the odds were for people before and how they still fought back and how they did win is an incredibly valuable lesson for people who are struggling right now, you know?
It really is. It really is. And I think, you know, we have We have some advantages in the instant communication that we have, and I think they had some advantages in having a smaller world in some ways to deal
yeah.
with. And
yeah.
I think they had, I think people back 100 years ago had more of a sense of themselves as workers. And I don't think we have a sense of ourselves as workers now. I think we see ourselves as salespeople, or I'm a cartoonist, I'm a freelancer, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah, there's
so
been a lot of cultural energy put into making people not identify as workers anymore.
That's right. Yeah. I make my own job. You know,
yeah.
I wouldn't need a union. You can't unionize salespeople because we, you know, we're go-getters and, you know. But, of course, every salesperson is driving on the roads that were built, you know, by the society as a whole, you know.
And the fantastic salespeople at Bloomingdale's in New York are all union, for example. And that's why they're able to stay there as a profession long term, you know, is that they can make a career out of it. So when you go to Bloomingdale's in the city and you want someone to help you find a suit that fits, that employee really freaking knows how to find you a suit that fits because that is their profession.
Okay.
You know,
well,
and that's you know what I mean? So, like, and there's, you know, New York is a number of, you know, Macy's and cities like that as well. And, that, you know, again, only in New York City, really, that I can think of. But you get the idea. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions I always like to ask
all of our guests here, and I know this is a bit of a jumping around, but are there any comic books that you are reading right now that you think folks should be picking up? Even if it's something old that you're just picking up now.
Boy, oh, boy, yeah. I have not read a new comic book in quite a while, I gotta tell you. I read the first Fletcher Hanks collection, which I very much enjoyed. I have a stack of stuff that I'm planning on reading, and one is, a religious comic from the 1970s called From Prison to Praise. And I'm not sure, it's based on some evangelical popular book of the time. So we'll see what that's like. I have an old Pep comic from about 1961, which is mostly, you know, Betty and Veronica, but it has a superhero story in the middle of it. And I've been collecting those for the superhero stories, which are pretty difficult to get. And some of them have some good art. There's a guy named John Ginta who worked with Wally Wood on his Thunder Agents book, who does some very nice artwork in those. And, yeah, I'm an old guy, see, so I'm like reliving my youth. And I'd have to think a while. I think the Fletcher Hanks thing is probably the closest thing to something new and relevant to most of your listeners that I've read.
You know, it's
where'd
funny
you find
that you mentioned, I had not... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Brett.
I was going to say, where'd you find that religious comic?
You know, it came up on a search for something else, and I collect all types of comics. So, you know, I have my little stack of Treasure Chest and the Archie Christian guys, and the Jack Chick Catholic sex abuse comic.
Oh, God!
And
you have a stronger stomach than me. One of my classmates, actually, she's in the popular band La Tigra. She did now that we're out of college and everyone's all professional. In college, she did a short film based on the Chick tracks, and from a critical standpoint, obviously, she's like a lesbian. But I was just like impressed that she was able to stomach reading them. I'm too sensitive. I, like, see them, and I just get so upset. I'm like, I can't look at this. This is so offensive. Get it away.
Oh, well, yeah, you'd have to. I grew up in California and actually went to school with his daughter and in an area with a lot of evangelicals in it. And I don't know. Those folks are okay. You know, they. I certainly can't justify a lot of his beliefs, and neither can the Bible, as a matter of fact. But I defend his right to believe it. And his daughter was a sweetheart. So
funny. Wow. I just remember reading they had this one, like, anti-Catholic one, and it was in Spanish, so it was obviously supposed to appeal to Spanish speakers, but the cartoons of Mexicans in it were so racist that I'm like, yeah, good luck with that. People totally convert to your side when you draw them as being subhuman. It's an excellent technique. Bravo.
Oh,
I mean, it was just
bad,
amazing to me. It was so amazing. They were totally drawing. They were like, it was the thing like Catholics should become evangelical or whatever. It was like a Pope, anti-Pope thing. And all the art in it was of these, like, completely caricaturist, racist drawings of Mexicans. And then there was in Spanish. And I was like, okay, good luck recruiting Mexican Catholics into evangelicism if your cartoons of them are racist.
Wow.
So it's like,
that
was amazing to me.
Was that one of the black and white ones or one of the color ones?
Yeah, it was one of the black and white ones. I'm almost positive it was one of the black and white ones. But yeah, that was a thing.
It's a small piece of the comics genre. I have a great collection of labor comics. I helped popularize a book called Joe Worker and the Story of Labor, which was put out in 1949 by the CIO, and that's become quite a popular comic among collectors and pretty expensive too. Most of the labor related comics, unfortunately, were right to work or anti union, with just a handful of things being put out by the there were a lot of comics done by the Railroad Brotherhood, but the Railroad Brotherhood is a very well off union. They're a very conservative, very strong union, and so they don't have to deal with a lot of working class issues. So they did some very, very nice comics that are kind of puff pieces for themselves without really addressing any political, guts.
And
do you know
when were these ones made?
Yeah, I was about to ask, like, what's the earliest political or labor comics?
Ooh, that's a rough one. I'd have to say the Joe Worker was the first one, the earliest one I've seen. I'm sure that comics were used in I'm sure the IWW used them.
Yeah, I've seen some.
You know, they had the silent agitators, which were small posters. They were like 3x5 posters, and they were illustrations or their Sabotage Cat.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that, and they sold them with a little bit of wallpaper paste on the back, so you could just like walk up the street and lick them and put them on a shop window.
You know, I still see posters from the International Workers of the World, the IWW, posted in places in New York. You know, people like new ones. I don't think that people are posting ones that are worth hundreds of dollars that were made 50 years ago. People are still making those and sharing those. Yeah.
It is still an active organization with a headquarters in Chicago and many, many branches. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in them to go to their website and check them out. They're a vital organization still.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. They were really supportive of the Starbucks workers who are trying to organize in the city. And I'm sure lots of other stuff. I just happen to know about the Starbucks campaign.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I this has been learning like a lot of stuff that I hadn't heard before, and I'll keep my eye out. I'll talk to Alex over at IBEW and see when this post gets posted online, so we can help send this out to our listeners as well.
I'm sure they are going to do something with it, and you know what? You might ask them if it's okay for you guys to put it up.
Yeah, I'd love to. I think that'd be great. I read it. It's a great comic.
I, Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I am, like I said, I am, my work is spread thinly enough through it that I can be, you know, very immodestly proud of it. I think it's, there have not been a lot of books like this, you know. There have not been a lot of commercial books like this within the past, like, 8 or 10 years. And of political comics, most of them have been right-wing and pretty reactionary, and of most of the labor comics, most of them have been right-to-work comics.
Mm.
So I am very proud of getting the message, the union message, out in this book, and I'm glad you guys liked it, and I hope some of your readers can find a copy. Almost everything is going to come up on the secondary market on eBay at some point. And I'll tell you, the CIA in the 80s commissioned a comic from a guy named Malcolm Ader, and it was to be airdropped over Grenada, I can't remember now, where we were pulling a little invasion under Ronald Reagan.
Yeah,
and it was to welcome the American troops. It was, oh, you know, look how terrible your government's been to you, and now the American troops are coming, and you should welcome them, and they're not going to hurt you. But those things show up. They were, it's kind of a funny story. They were commissioned by the CIA, and when they picked up the original art, they met the publisher in a taxi cab, and they drove around Washington, D.C. for about 20 minutes, and they gave him something like $20,000 in cash in a briefcase.
Huh. That is probably a record high for getting paid for your work, I would imagine.
Isn't that nice?
In entire comic book history, right?
He couldn't believe it. But I'll tell you, those comics that were never supposed to show up in this country are available on eBay. You just got to look around for them. They're called Grenada.
There's a great
Grenada.
Yeah, there's a great site, and I can't think of it off the top of my head, that does a lot of scans of old political comic books. And I'm pretty sure I've read that one. I love going on there whenever they post up new stuff because it's fascinating. Like, they had one from, I want to say, like, 84, or no, it would be in the 88 Republican convention slamming Dukakis, which was amazing to read. And I think there was one from, like, the 76 Republican convention. It's a great site, and I wish I remember what its name was. But
it
just posts up
like
gems all the time.
It sounds like you're talking about my buddy Ethan Persoff,
yes,
who is a great cartoonist. He pulled the McCain-Bush Tijuana Bible hoax at the Republican convention.
Interesting.
What?
Yeah, that's
so somebody
right.
said that
that's,
they found Tijuana Bibles with them on it?
Yeah, of McCain and George Bush. And
sterile.
Oh, it's hilarious. He did a beautiful job. He's a great cartoonist, a great caricaturist, and pretty crazy, I guess. And a great archivist. He has archived the whole of Paul Krassner's Realist on his site. Do you know Krassner and the Realist and his connection with Mad Magazine and Wally Wood and...
Yeah, I'm
I know.
We could have a whole show on that stuff sometime. I'm a 60s geek, so these things come, I don't know any of them firsthand, but I know them all from reading about it.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show. This has been
fun. You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Is there any other comics you have coming up soon or anything you want to plug before?
No, I do a lot of weird commercial stuff and ghosting that I really can't talk about, but I'm out there.
Well, so if people want to find you, where can they, like, what your website that they can
TomChristopher.com, and if people have enjoyed any of the topics of this conversation, labor unions, fringe comics, the Beat Generation, it's all there at TomChristopher.com.
Cool. I appreciate it.
That's great.
Thanks for coming on.
Okay. I appreciate it, too. Thank you very much. Crashed
Thank
my
you.
Server tonight. Okay. Bye-bye.
We'll make a business of it.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Wow, that is really wild.
Well, that was really interesting. Like, I mean, I've been trying to think and rack my brain as to what union I belong to. Like, and it had been 17 years ago. And I can't for the life of me remember what it was.
What job,
like
17
was
it or 18.
What
job was
I was
was
working
it?
At a supermarket.
You were probably United Food and Commercial Workers.
I have no idea. I paid my check or whatever.
Trust me on these things, Brad. Trust me on these things. Well, anyway, it was really cool to be able to take a look at that comic. But I wanted to make sure we had some time this week to talk about some comics news that we just got around the pipe.
Hell yeah. So let's start off with the sad news. So this with Solicits coming out for, I think, August or September. It has come hit the news that Journey into a Mystery, a favorite comic of yours, and one that I've enjoyed, is coming to an end with, I think, issue 535. It ends with a 5 or 565. Whatever it is, 5-something-5. So there's like 3 more issues left. Rather unfortunate.
Yeah, it really is sad, because the comic was really getting its stride, I think, and it was always really strong. And it seems to me like, I don't know. I mean, are they going to say, oh, see, comics about women characters don't sell? Or, like, what's their excuse for canceling it? And for that matter, Journey into Mystery is just a legacy. Like, there's always been a Journey into Mystery comic, I think, right? It's where Thor comes
from. There's been times it wasn't. Yeah, it's always kind of flowed into Thor and in and out of Thor. So my thing, though, is there's very little difference other than it starring Sif between what's being put out now and what came before, and it lasted a hell of a long time before. So I just find it fascinating, like, now is the time of, hey, we're going to get rid of this. Plus the fact that it's one of those few series that they didn't relaunch with the Marvel Now, and I'm wondering if that hurt it.
Yeah, I do wonder. I don't know.
Conspiracy theory time.
It's really sad. It was such a fun comic, and it really seems stupid of Marvel to cancel it. I wrote on my Tumblr, canceling this comic seems like a really DC thing to do.
I went there. Yeah, it's kind of... it's a little baffling. I enjoyed it. Like, I'm kind of just shocked, and there's so much other crap that's being put out. And the one thing I will say, at least they are dropping other bad comics as well, so it's not like this is a void.
Ooh, what's getting dropped? That's bad. They don't have to do any Liefeld stuff, do they?
No. I believe Morbius is getting dropped, and that I don't shed a tear at all, because that comic's horrible.
I never looked at it.
I'd be tempted to review it just so I could shit on one comic a month.
Gotcha.
It's really bad. It's sad.
We really look forward to seeing the next of her work. We really look forward to seeing the next of her work when it comes out. And like, she's really a great writer, and we really enjoyed seeing Journey into Mystery. I was walking from the comic book shop today, and I saw an ad on a phone booth. Yes, a phone booth. I saw a phone booth. Second of all, the phone booth had an ad on it for buying comics about Superman. And it was tied into
the movie. I've heard about this. I have heard about this. I haven't seen anything. Snap a photo if you can with your phone,
so I can post it up. Yeah, it was bizarre to see an ad for. But you know, we were always saying, like, there needs to be more advertising for comics. It would have been stronger had they used an image from the movie, I think, than they didn't use any images from the movie. But it was still good to see. But it was so random to seeing it on a phone booth. I didn't even know there were phone booths, for one thing. I suppose Superman needs a place to change, you know. And it was located about down the block from the Midtown Comics, so it's in Lower Manhattan. So you could have met that, but the sign did not tell you how to get to the comic book store, though. But it was paid for by DC Comics, you know. So it might have.
Yeah, I heard.
Comics, if you go to this URL or whatever, I don't know. It's a start. Or something.
Yes, snap a photo if you see it. Like, I heard about it, but I haven't seen it anywhere. I mean, I will throw DC Comics some props in that they're at least they launched a new Superman comic the week that Man of Steel opened up. They gave a bunch of comics away for free in comic shops, and I think in Sears was the other one.
Okay, because if they only did it in comic shops, I'm going to punch them. But if they do it in theaters, I'm going to high-five them.
Yeah. They put in Sears, so you know, I give them some props for getting out there and trying to actually have a decent marketing to get people who might be interested in the movie, or not even decent, how about some marketing that might get people interested into the from the movie into the comic series. So there's at least that.
So you saw the movie?
I did see the movie. It was interesting.
Do I want to see the movie?
So there's a lot I liked. There's a lot I disliked. It seems it has polarized the community. That people either hate it or love it, which is fine. I think that it's not. Some people are just too dug in, you know, with their heels on stuff. I mean, generally the first half of it, or first third of it, or two thirds of it, whatever, really, really good. And then the final third is a lot of punching and buildings collapsing. It was kind of, you know, a big spectacle of, you know, that you'd expect from a Zack Snyder movie. The one thing I will say that I really, really liked is that it is not the origin of Superman. I would argue the movie is the origin of Clark Kent, which is a nice flip to every other superhero movie we've seen come out. Because every other one, and I was talking to a friend about it, was like Batman. You know, Bruce Wayne, something happens, goes off, becomes Batman, comes and fights crime. Peter Parker is Peter Parker, a normal person. We get used to him, gets bitten by a spider, something happens, fights crime. Iron Man, normal dude, builds a suit of armor, winds up fighting crime. It's always like, here's a normal person who becomes the superhero. Whereas this flips it a bit, and at least it is the superhero trying to figure out his role and how this all... you know, plays with his life, which was, or fits in his life, which was a nice change from everything that's come before. So I'll at least give him props on that.
Well, that doesn't sound like it's going to get me into the theater.
It did well, so I will.
Yeah,
it's worth to see. Like, if you get it on TV or something like that, it's definitely kind of like worth checking out. If nothing else, to deconstruct the movie versus comics, and it gets interesting when you start doing the stuff like that. I mean, the movie did $125 million in 4 days. It's in the top June opener ever. It's already at like $200 million globally. It's rocking. So I expect it to do really, really well and possibly top out at the top grossing of the year, but we'll see. And audiences love it, even though critics seem to hate it. Or are mixed on it, at least. So, we'll see. We'll see from here.
On to other important topics. I finally was able to read FF.
Yes. Did you get to the panel that I loved?
I did. I know exactly the panel that you loved and you thought of me about.
Can I read?
I'm sure it'll be used. You should read it. Do you have it handy? It should be.
I do.
It'll become a classic on Tumblr. My theory is that it'll be used to illustrate a billion Tumblr conversations.
Yes. I'm trying to figure out how the hell to use this and use this as often as possible because it's kind of amazing. So to read the line for everyone of why I was so giddy last episode, this is the line from The Wizard is, useless, useless, all of you pale before our heteronormative, cisgendered classification of family, which is so brilliant. It's, yeah, easily one of the best things that have been written in months.
And then the next thing he says is, blast star, show them all how nuclear a family we truly can be, which is just amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, the whole comic is the Wizards trying to say that a family is this very one specific narrow thing, and then everyone in the comic, including the gender variant, Moloids, and the... women and children of various ages and nationalities and species are all fighting back and saying, no, we're a family too. And Scott Lang you know, has this great line, the wizard in the next time, I will remake this world, whole world in my image, and Scott Lang says, your image is boring, creep, and then punches him out. And I think that's really the takeaway, is, you know, like, look at how much more whole and diverse and interesting the world is when you are opening, when you open to other people, you know what I mean? And I think what's really interesting to me is at the end of the comic, you know, it's been out for a while, I feel like it's okay to spoiler it. In the end of the comic, the good guys win and the bad guys lose. I know, shocking. But there's a scene where Medusa basically explains, like, look, the wizard is just a sick, old, crazy man. You know, he doesn't understand what he's doing. And it just sort of posits, like, all of those people who are anti-marriage equality and who are, you know, bigoted against transgendered people and who are trying to create this, like, nuclear family that never really existed, as they hold that up as the only norm and the only thing that's ever been supported by our culture and our Bible. It's just putting them as being clueless, basically, and demented and doddering and old and fading away, you know, which I think is a feeling a lot of people have. Certainly the demographics seem to point to that being the case. So,
yeah, I mean, like, as a whole, there's so much right with this issue and this line, like, I am so giddy and so happy the fact that Matt Fraction wrote this and presented it and had the storyline he's got. It's exactly what you say it is. It you know, it really kind of puts out, it does what comics are supposed to do. It takes modern issues and creates a parable out of it and a lesson and, you know, comments on modern times through humor and action and, you know, funny looking characters. Like, it's perfect. This is exactly what a comic's supposed to be. Yeah. So awesome. I knew you were going to smile on that one.
Oh my God. It made me so happy. And once again, the art in this comic is so strong and so dynamic and it's so well written. There is something really ominous at the end, the way they basically say, they send the wizard off, like, you know, Black Bolt would have some words with you, Bentley Whitman. I mean, that's, right, if Black Bolt speaks, you get blown up, right? That's kind of like,
yeah.
If the wizard is this, you know, losing his mind, old, crazy man, then that doesn't sound like a fair to essentially explode him. You know.
Well, that was the one thing I caught, too. I was just like, oh, my God. And at the same time, wondering, I have to imagine it really means what they're saying it is. Like, clearly, Black Bolt whispered or did something, and will we see the wizard again ever? Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah, it's exactly what you said. It's ominous. Like, it's a really dark ending. And then immediately turns into, like, this goofy thing that I can't wait for the next story arc. Because it has Doom.
Oh, and
I
love the outfit that Medusa's wearing. She's wearing, like, a long caftan when she gets back to
yep.
the Inhumans planet. I love that look on her. She's so, like, early 70s-tastic that I really do think that they should have her wear a lot more caftans. I think caftans should be much more popular fashion choice for a lot of the Jack Kirby-inspired superhero characters.
It's great. I mean, like, the whole issue is there's so much right with it. So much good.
Mm-hmm. And there's a really fantastic cloak of Kirby colors that is devised
yep.
to power contain Blastar. I don't even know who Blastar is, but... But yeah, folks, really should be reading this comic. It is such an unadulterated joy. It makes me so happy
yes.
reading it every month. You know.
And the other one that we loved was Wolverine and the X-Men 31, which was the part
yeah,
one of the Hellfire
issue.
Saga.
That's a comic that had gone through some bumps, but now it's going to be doing some really cool stuff. It looks like.
So the greatness of this comic. I was reading it out loud, or wasn't reading out loud, I was reading it, my girlfriend's sitting next to me, and I'm chuckling, like, every couple seconds, just laughing, and she's like, what? And I started reading the courses, so the story is basically that some of these mutants get kidnapped, or they kind of go on their own, and head to a school that's kind of like the antithesis of the Jean Grey school, and it's run by the new Hellfire Club. So everything's evil, and the courses are awesome. I mean, it just goes through exactly what you think, and they're really funny, and it brings back the humor of the beginning of the first issues of the series. I was reading
yet.
To her.
Where did you get it in the preview? Is that where you saw?
You don't have 31?
I have the one where they leave at the end of it to go to and kid Kid Omega.
You are one behind then.
I was just in the store today.
Okay, I'll shut my mouth.
That sounds fantastic. It sounds really exciting. I'd love to hear about the coursework.
It's awesome. Yeah, I mean, like, we could do a show just about the coursework because there's so much brilliant humor throughout the issue. So I will not ruin it and wait for when you get to the issue, and we will totally talk about it because it's beyond awesome.
Cool. Well, I'm definitely looking forward to it. I think that they're doing creative things to make the Hellfire Club scary again, you know?
And fun. That's the other thing I love about it. Like, they're scary and they are formidable, but they're fun at the same time because it's a bunch of kids that are this new Hellfire Club, which is beyond entertaining.
Yeah. And it definitely has a lot of class critique, I think, hidden in there as well.
Yes, absolutely. Anything else that we want to touch on?
No, I guess that is it for me.
Okay, well, we will save Wolverine and the X-Men discussions for, like, probably next time or whenever you can pick up the comic. Because it's awesome. I mean, there's a few comics that I've been laughing out loud and to the point where it was disturbing the person next to me, this was one of them.
Nice. That's always a good endorsement.
Yes. And she would endorse it, too, because I was reading this stuff for her, and she's like, this is awesome. Wasn't enough that I could get her to read it, but she liked it. So I guess that will wrap up this latest episode. So everyone, thank you for listening. You can catch us daily at graphicpolicy.com and follow us on Twitter, Google+, and Facebook, and chat with us and other comic book fans. And as more of you head out to catch the Man of Steel in theaters, remember that no matter your opinion, there are others who might have walked away with a different one. We have an obligation to show that fandom can disagree without being disagreeable, and thus welcoming everyone into the fold, no matter their viewpoint. So until next week, I'm Brett.
And I'm Ilana.
And keep reading and stay geeky.